Hi, and welcome to another Glenn and Helen podcast. Our guests today are so far our most popular guests on this show, Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan. Our last episode with them has already been downloaded over 125,000 times, and people keep writing and asking us to get them back. So we thought we'd have them back today, talking about military matters around the world, and in particular, an issue that's getting a lot of attention right now.
One of the biggest questions today has to do with the takeover of management at five U.S. ports by a company from the United Arab Emirates. It's created a firestorm of protests in the blogosphere and on Capitol Hill. We'll ask our guests what they think.
Stay tuned.
I've been reading books by Claire Bielinski and Bruce Bauer on Muslims in Europe, and both of them say that they don't assimilate very well and that welfare and discrimination combine to produce terrorism. What can Europe do, and will they do anything?
Well, it's not all Europe's fault. The big problem has been cheap travel. It's been a problem all over the world, including the United States. I mean, it used to be a couple of generations ago that when you immigrated to another country, you were gone for good. In Ireland, they used to hold what they called, you know, wakes for the migrants because the parents knew they'd never see their kids again. That is no longer the case. And one of the unexpected consequences of that is that people are able to stay in touch with the culture that they left. As a consequence, they don't break the bonds of that culture. In the old days, the only problem we had was the adult migrants got into fights with their kids because the kids became Americans, but the parents still had one foot, so to speak, culturally speaking, in the old world. Now, the parents can afford to send the kids back to the old country, you know, to go to, you know, Al-Qaeda school or whatever. That puts the kids in the same situation that only the parents, you know, had to face a couple of generations
ago. Don't some immigrants, they assimilate better? I mean, don't some people assimilate better?
The problem is acute with people coming from, how should I put it, rural, non-cosmopolitan backgrounds. I mean, mm-hmm. It's not just the Muslims from the Middle East. The same pattern is seen, for example, with the Hmong refugees from Laos. They were a tribal people. You know, they hadn't lived in cities, and all of a sudden they were in this very, very strange, you know, environment. It's not impossible. A lot of them do assimilate, but what we are seeing is an increase in the number that do not assimilate, and they are the ones that are causing the problems. Another consequence of this, or another contributing factor, are the worldwide communications. You know, for example, the cable news. I have seen this in the United States since Al Jazeera and other, you know, Arab cable television news stations have gone on the air and become available to anybody who's willing to pay their cable bill. You find a lot of the children of migrants, as well as their parents who came over here, getting most of their news from the basically news outlets from back home. And I found out about it because I heard from one friend of mine who had their kids were going to the same school as some kids from, I don't know, Yemen, I think. And the kids were kind of perplexed because they were getting a totally different spin on things from Al Jazeera, because the parents insisted that the kids watch Al Jazeera so they'd improve their language skills. The kids really didn't want to learn, you know, Arabic any better than they had to. And that apparently is not uncommon. So you have a problem where the assimilation, which solved the culture clash problems, which have been going on for thousands of years, is now keeping this disease, shall we say, for want of a better term, alive. It's obviously in everybody's best interest to assimilate. Why go to this foreign country unless you want to become part of that foreign country? People are basically torn. In the old days, the problem with the parents would die out when the parents died. You know, I've gone to more than a few wakes where the parents were migrants, and in one case, the gal, I never knew this. In fact, I never met her mother until, you know, she got really sick and I went to visit her in a hospital. Her mother from Italy never learned how to speak English.
I'm going to toss out something a little bit more insidious.
Go ahead, Austin.
As we're sitting here, I was listening to Jim describe the effects of, it's an oxymoron, near distance, but it's because of 747s, jet travel and quick travel. He's absolutely right on the technological advantage, but there is also an element, and I'm trying to remember the name of the group that grew out of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And essentially, in Arabic, it means essentially faithful or believers in exile. And the group comes out of the 1970s. It's Tafiq something. Of course, I'm on this podcast. I'll have everybody in the world send me an email and explain what the group is. But they believed that they could never work the Islamist, the Salafist revolution inside Egypt, given the nature of the autocratic Egyptian regime. And the place to do this was in a more open society, so they formed a group. And remember, this is a group that ultimately intersects and morphs into a variety of al-Qaeda type affiliates. They were going to carry out this proselytization in exile, and that it often meant in other places in Europe, and that includes Great Britain. And for the life of me, of course, that's the problem of doing something on radio like this. I cannot come up with the name of the organization off the top of my head. That is the kind of seedbed, however, that over time, working through some of the radical mosques that have cropped up in Europe, helps reinforce this sense of not simply a personal or cultural identity, but a radical and an impenetrable identity.
Yeah, but I think we should put it in perspective. I know when the 93 bombs went off in the World Trade Center, I was the terrorism pundit for several of the outlets in the New York area. And I was already aware of what was going on down in Brooklyn with Abdulrahman. There'd been some things in the news about somebody was murdered. There was basically a feud going on in that particular mosque. What has happened in the United States is that the majority of Muslims want nothing to do with these radicals. But the radicals are a bunch of thugs. They will kill, and that's exactly what happened down in Brooklyn, in order to try and take control of the mosques and then spread their poison. This whole problem of, cultural imperialism, again, speaking as a historian, is nothing new. In United States, up until 1917, there were over 100 German-language newspapers. The German immigrant community was very strong in maintaining their German identity, even though they were Americans. They fought in the American Civil War, et cetera, they still maintained, if not ties to the old country, ties to the old country culture. That all disappeared practically overnight when we went to war with Germany. But it shows you that it's nothing unique with the Muslims. And to our benefit, the majority of Muslims want to assimilate. And that's what's happened. And now in Europe, it's different, because in Europe, you got to remember, unlike the United States, their whole idea of national identity and citizenship is based on what they call blood. They're still in Jim Crow country.
Well, a nation in the sense of a tribe, a nation state built around
genealogy, yes.
Cultural identity.
And whereas the United States is more like, we forget, we based our nation on ancient Rome, and the Roman founding myth was basically a bunch of wanderers, a bunch of people thrown out of other cities and tribes, and coming together and forming something new. Most people don't realize that about Rome and how important it was into the founding of the United States. Our founding fathers were aware of that. They said, well, hey, we're a bunch of mongrels. We're doing it a different way. And it turned out to be a superior way, and something that is one of those things that Europe doesn't really want to admit that they hold against this. They're thoroughbreds, and we're just a bunch of mutts, and the mutts are, basically running faster than the purebreds.
I love that Bill Murray speech in Stripes.
Glenn, in the auto de fe, the French car burning, is that there's a lot of resentment at the superficiality of the French Republican model, which alleges to be incorporative, but it's got lurking back there the French identity that Jim is alluding to.
Yeah, they preach egalite and they basically talk tribalism.
That's right.
And of course, you'll see that's rampant in France. Pardon me, is from France, and I have kinfolk in France.
They're
very acute. In fact, when I was in high school, I learned when I took French, I went to my aunt and and tried to get some help on acquiring a Breton, you know, accent so I could piss off the teacher who was from Paris.
Let me come back just to my point about the radicalization. Jim's right. You know, the German language papers, newspapers in the big East Coast cities were an example. They weren't all simply there. There were a couple that were publishing even down here in Texas, in the Texas Deutsch Central Hill Country region. Of course, you had some in Pennsylvania as well. The phenomenon crops up with Hispanic immigrants to the United States. We have a very lively and active Spanish press in the United States. Of course, it represents a very broad spectrum of opinion. The radical element that I described, and of course, it's on me to try to come up with a name of the group. Nevertheless, you've certainly seen the effects of that kind of ideological separateness, and that is one of the that I think is one of the differentiators. It's not simply religion, not simply language, but that radical stroke, that radical element that takes advantage and preys upon that separate upon the separate identity. I don't think that can be dismissed. However, I do not buy in to any of the, how to describe it, profiling of both the left and right about you know, Muslims and Arabs, in part because of all the time that I've spent in the Muslim world. You find such a range of opinion, range of experience, that it's really ludicrous to talk in many ways about a quote-unquote Muslim world.
Well, but it can become a serious problem. We must remember, in the late 19th century, the Irish were basically the Islamic, you know, terrorists, you know, of the United States. The Irish Republicans, I mean, there were several instances. In one case, they tried to invade Canada. You know, there were thousands of them. They were armed. They were killing people. It's not a new phenomenon, but it's simply made worse with modern technology. You know, the Irish had to basically, you know, publish their own radical newspapers and pass them around. Well, now you can just get on Al Jazeera, and the news travels with the speed of light. So it's going to be more of a problem. You know, also, for example, down in Texas, you have that problem in Mexico. You go to Mexico, you go down to Mexico City, they have a plaza down there which has all the flags of the provinces of Mexico. They also have flags for New Mexico, Arizona, and Texas, the lost provinces. You know, so they have this memory that can be part of the arsenal, you know, of radicals, and that's one thing. I don't know about Texas, but I know they talk about a lot in California, but then again, they talk about a lot of stuff out there.
Well, let me shift the topic a little, but it's actually quite related to this, because of the discussion over the port takeover by the Dubai Ports Company from the United Arab Emirates. You almost hear a kind of profiling, and it's interesting that it's coming from people on the left as well as people on the right. And,
yeah, but it's mostly demagoguery. The sad thing about that situation is it's all demagoguery working against the interests of the United States. People forget, this will probably come out bit by bit over the next few days, the UAE is our best ally over there. It is not like the rest of Arabia. It has, you know, it's only about 3 million people. Only 20% of them are residents. 80% of them are foreign workers. They have a per capita GDP of $30,000. There's been practically zilch Al-Qaeda activity in the UAE, and for good reason. The business of the UAE is business. They want nothing to do with radicalism, although it's, you know, it's a collection of seven monarchies basically run by Dubai and Abu Dhabi. They have been very forthright in staying away from any kind of radicalism. They've shared out the money, the oil and gas money, a lot more equitably than in any other part of the Gulf, including Iran. And they have only gotten by for centuries by basically staying out of the fights of the big guys in the neighborhood. That's why they have always been particularly close to Britain and the United States. I mean, they're the one place besides Kuwait where we can operate air bases and have military personnel basically do whatever we have to do.
Well, I would add that I have heard from friends of mine, reservist, National Guard, and I think of one active duty fellow, active duty component as well, that are in logistics primarily praise the cooperation they've got from the United Arab Emirates, the UAE. Now, again, that's on the guys who are on the supply side of the house. Now I'm going to move to rumor, and it's Officers Club rumor, but that the UAE is extremely cooperative with civil affairs operations in the Persian Gulf region. They've also, with their security personnel, worked closely with CENTCOM and SOCOM on let's call them cultural understanding, cultural interpretation, and those have to be acknowledged. If that's the case, and I believe it to be the case that the UAE has cooperated extensively in those kinds of often sensitive but very important military and security operations.
And there's a reason for that.
You have to give them credit for that.
But now there's a reason for that, a very practical reason for that. The only reason that the Emirates are still independent was because the British protected them from the Saud family when the Sauds were running around basically conquering everything in Arabia. The other problem is they still have an open border dispute with Saudi Arabia, and two islands in the Persian Gulf were seized recently by Iran because of an ongoing dispute over who exactly owns the Taub, I believe it is, islands. Their only friends, the only people who are going to keep them independent, are outside of the Gulf, basically the big guys, the United States and Britain. And indeed, you know, Abdulaziz, the founder of the Saudi, you know, kingdom, he made a very interesting statement when he basically agreed to, when he met with Roosevelt and agreed to become an ally of the United States. When asked why, he says, "Well, the United States is far away, you know, so we can basically trust them more than anybody else to be the kind of a friend who won't move in on us."
He's also supposed to have gotten some advice from a former British advisor that the United States would be far more fairer to him in terms of contracts than the British ever would, but that may well be.
Well, he already had experience with the British, so he probably figured he couldn't do much worse.
Yeah. Let's go to analyze a couple of things about the about port operations in the United States. Do you have to conduct the port operations under the eye and the authority of the local port authority and the Coast Guard and the local police? Of course you do. Do you have to operate with American unions? Of course you do. What I can tell so far, and Glenn, I think Congress has a legitimate, very legitimate role here in investigating how the contracting was done. But I ultimately think you've got to find out that not only is the company on the up and up, that the kinds of security issues that the UAE is being alleged about having this Arab company run it are the same kind of security issues that you had with a British company or any international organization running large port operations.
You got to remember, the UAE has more to lose than anybody else if something goes wrong at one of those ports they're running.
It's a big business for them, isn't it, Jim?
Well, not just that. I'm talking about not just economically, but they depend on our friendship to keep, you know, Saudi Arabia from expanding the kingdom a little bit like they'd originally planned to do, or from having the Iranians coming over and say, you know, this is the Persian Gulf and we're going to show you why. They have a great... Remember, only 20% of the 3 million people in the UAE are citizens. It's a very small population sitting on, you know, about 100 billion barrels of oil and a lot more natural gas. They know they have a good thing going, and they don't want to lose it. So they have absolutely no incentive to tolerate any kind of terrorist, you know, infiltration into their port operations. By the way, they run ports all over the world. I mean,
yeah,
that's their business.
They have a. This was explained to me by a fellow in Kenya that had done business in the UAE. That they have got run out of I believe it's out of Dubai, a used car trading business that essentially moves used cars not only around the Arabian Peninsula but the African coast as well.
A big market.
He told me he was going to try to buy one, but he had to fly to Dubai sometime to make the deal. Anyway, that was...
Yeah, the Japanese have this big thing about getting rid of cars when they're still perfectly good, and it provides an enormous used car market, especially in the Middle East.
Well, what you're describing, though, is a country that is not only has the capital source of its oil and gas deposits, they're also a trading nation, and they're trying to do something other than operate solely on petrodollars.
You got to remember, that's a big difference between Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. The Gulf states were always basically the trading ports on the coast that got the stuff, as it were, the goods, for the Bedouin tribes who bring in dates, whatever they had.
Are you trying to tell me they were smugglers, Jim?
Not smuggling. No, I mean that's like the cities along the east coast of Africa.
Yeah.
They were basically traders. They got the foreign goods. They had their little fortified towns because sometimes the Bedouins wouldn't pay or didn't want to pay. And that's how they survived before the oil came along. Now, what happened was when the oil did come along, they didn't just say, hey, we can all buy Cadillacs and put up houses and air conditioning and just live off the money. No, they said, hey, we have more money to make more money. That's why their economy is going up, while in Saudi Arabia, you have 20% unemployment. Per capita GDP has been declining for the last 10 years. They're very nervous about what's going to happen in Saudi Arabia, because if they get unstable and they, get taken over by a religious dictatorship, who's going to help the Emirates? That's why they're the best people to have running our ports. They have our best interests.
Well, Glenn and Ellen, sounds like for several reasons, a spectrum of reasons, Jim and I think it's a pretty good, reasonable thing to go ahead and let this UAE company take over the port operations. Again, I do think Congress has a legitimate interest in conducting the investigation.
But there's
to reassure people that are concerned about it. I will say, to take a step back a bit and look at the response, this is another indication that people are still correctly worried about 9/11 and know that a war is going on.
Yeah, but another problem is, if you went into Congress and said what we just said, you'd be in big political trouble, saying that, Saudi Arabia is a bunch of, wastrels and they've ruined their economy and the UAE is basically depending on us to protect them against their neighbors. That is very impolitic. Now, we're private citizens. We can say that. But if you're a politician or if you're a member of the government, maybe they can say that in private and, the politicians just decided, well, let's run with this because the media is going to jump all over it as a... it's something that's going to just let a bunch of Arabs come in and blow up our ports. The truth is there, but it's sometimes very hard to say it politically.
Well, Jim, you're the one who called them wastrels. I would put it this way. They have squandered one of the greatest natural resource opportunities to...
That's another definition of a wastrel.
Yeah. and for whatever reasons done, they...
Cultural.
It's a terrible situation to have seen that kind of waste.
Oh, no, they're going through hard times now because the Saudi Arabia also has millions of expatriate workers, and with the 20% unemployment, they are now looking around saying, well, why do we have all this unemployment? I mean, to a certain extent, it's similar to the situation in the United States. Why can't we get Americans to pick the crops? Well, it's dirty work. But in Saudi Arabia, you're talking about jobs that, 90% of Americans would take, white-collar jobs, working in stores, retail, wholesale, you name it. Too many of the Saudis just say, hey, if I can't be a manager, I don't want to work. They have a real cultural problem.
So here we're jumping it. There are some real cleavages in that society, too, and one of them is going to be the port traders. Dairon, Khobar have a different view than... In the Nedged and in Riyadh, and they're the folks where the big boats come in.
Not only that, most of them are Shias.
Yeah, or
that's another problem.
Shias, which is a column. Actually, Jim, you may remember this. I think about 18 months ago, where I talked about when I was in Khobar and actually went and did a little shopping, and the fellow I was with said, "Austin, I have talked to this salesman, the shop owner, about you. Why don't you ask him about his faith?" And I did, and he very carefully, because we had a mutual friend, and he told him, here is this writer from the United States, chat a little bit, and he says, well, in public, yes, we are Sunni in private. He says, there are a lot of us around here that are Shias. And whatever the estimate is, it doesn't show up on the Saudis' published demographics, but there are a significant number of Shias that you will find in the northeastern part of the country.
You got to remember, this causes problems throughout the Middle East. Most of the Saudi Arabian oil is in the part of the kingdom that is occupied primarily by Shias. Most of the oil in Iran is located in the part of the country that is occupied mostly by Arabs. In Iraq, most of the oil is located in parts of the country populated by either Shias or Kurds. This puts the Sunni Arabs at an enormous disadvantage, something they're not unaware of. And this is the cause of a lot of the unrest over there, this business of, if we're sitting on the oil, why aren't we benefiting from it?
And we've seen that play out not only in Saudi Arabia, but that was also one of
Nigeria.
The best elements in Iraq as well, and the like.
Can we move for just a minute from the Middle East to the Philippines and hear a little about what you think is going on over there?
The Muslims are finally making peace. They've gotten tired. Well, actually, the problem in the Philippines has been that 500 years ago, Muslim preachers came up and converted the tribes in the southern islands. And then the Spanish came along about the same time, and they started, converting the northern tribes to be Christians. This set up a conflict situation which has never been, resolved. It's been exacerbated by the fact that the Christian part of the islands basically prospered relative to the Muslim parts for various reasons, not all of them cultural. And in the last generation or so, there's been a lot of Christian migration down into the southern islands. Now, this has caused about 20 years of civil war as the Moros tried to hang on to what they thought was their part of the Philippine Islands. They had the MILF, the major separatist organization, has worked out a peace deal, which is, about this far away from being signed and sealed, but they basically agreed to the major points. You still have some factions of the Muslim, separatist movements like Abu Sayyaf, which still want to fight on, but they are very much minorities. Not just Abu Sayyaf, but there are several other factions, which are basically just bandits, kidnapping gangs and what have you.
There's a faction of the Moro Liberation Front that broke off because there was a peace deal working in the late 1980s after the overthrow.
Yes, the Bob was the MILF. That's the one they're negotiating with now. They made peace once in the 90s, but then there was the one big faction, a large faction broke away. They kept fighting, but they have now made peace, so to speak. So the only thing they have left is the Abu Sayyaf, which are half bandits and half Al-Qaeda wannabes. There's also Jemaah Islamiyah, which is from Indonesia. Again, they are, it's a similar situation, it's a situation in Indonesia where the majority of Indonesians practice a very un-Islamic form of Islam. That'll get me in trouble with many Indonesians. Like in many countries that converted to Catholicism, it was a somewhat superficial conversion. Let me put it this way, they still worship some of the old gods. You still see this in the Middle East, the Druze and the Alawites. They are suspect because they didn't go all the way when they accepted Islam.
You're going to get the Alawites to jump you on that, but the thing is, though, is if you look at what has leaked out about Alawitism and what the Sunnis say when the
about the Shia. Well, especially in Iran, they still practice a lot of the old Zoroastrian, customs.
They talk about it as syncretic Islam.
But what has happened in Indonesia is that in the urban areas, you have had a growth in Wahhabism, because one of the unanticipated blowbacks from the huge inflow of oil money into the Middle East, since the 70s when OPEC was formed, was a lot of the money went back out through Islamic charities for proselytizing, setting up Wahhabi, and we've heard about this before, but this is the end result. It starts up these hardcore Islamic movements in areas that are not hardcore, and these are the ones you try and get going with starting another jihad and making everybody old school Islamic. It doesn't work. And it's not working, although all we hear about is the things that go boom. But the majority of people in, say, Indonesia want nothing to do with this kind of Islam, which they consider foreign. Not only is it foreign, but it's violent and it's bad for business.
Let's go back real quick to the to the Philippines. Abu Sayyaf is a problem in a lot of ways. It's as much as Jim said a gang as it is a radical Islamist, and what the kind of gang it is a pirate gang that has some protection out of corrupt police forces, corrupt Coast Guard forces,
and a couple of large ransoms.
Smuggling is exactly. I work in the hostage and ransom. Ransom angle, kidnapping, but they do have strong contacts with Jamaat Islamiyya, which in my view is just Al-Qaeda in Southeast Asia. That's what JI says basically about itself itself anyway, and they are a problem because, of the links that they will, what they'll do and what they would potentially do. Let's go back to a couple of, you asked what was going on. Here's the Philippines' big issue in one word, and that is corruption. That is the corruption that saps the economic dynamism of the country. You still have an oligarchy out of Manila. You
three
have
dozen families owning most of the land.
You've got the Philippines are an evolving democracy. And they are, you know, the thing is they need to be encouraged. They need to get credit for what they've accomplished. But where do I get that one word description from? Actually, from Filipinos I know.
Yeah.
Their own critique of the system. Time magazine has an interesting article this week. I had linked to it where they talk about how the people power revolutions, the beginning with tossing out Marcos in February of 86 has acted as a democratic accelerator in some ways to get around some of the structural autocratic elements in the way that the politics are conducted there in the Philippines. It's I think the reason you asked the question is because the coup rumors broke out. Well, as a couple of people emailed me after I put some links up there, you know, Austin, we've got coup rumors that fly on a monthly basis. That's true. The part of the reason for that is because that you have had cadres of, and this is the way they describe themselves and have been described of young disgruntled quote unquote progressive officers, educated individuals that say, hey, we've got to change this system. So. That's whether the coups occur or not. I think that's a component of what.
Let me put it more in perspective. In 1947, when Britain, you know, left India, they left India and Pakistan as separate countries. Now these were very similar, you know, culturally, et cetera, et cetera. India then proceeded to do much better than Pakistan. There was one primary reason for that. After the when India was established, one of the first things they did was they addressed the landlord problem, the fact that a small number of families or, you know, monarchs, you know, aristocrats, whatever you want to call it, owned most of the land and basically ran a lot of the population as serfs. They basically bought all the land with government bonds and paid them off and said, look, you know, you can either sit on your money, clip coupons, or invest in new businesses, whatever, but you're not going to be landowners anymore. They created a class of, I guess you'd call them yeoman farmers. And these farmers prospered. This was, you know, an offshoot of the Green Revolution in the 50s and 60s and what have you. Much better yields and whatever. And this basically provided a huge middle class for India. This did not happen in Pakistan. They did not break up the huge, you know, family estates. And you still have this feudal problem. It's feudalism you're dealing with all throughout, you know, Southeast Asia. And of course, the Chinese broke it up with their cultural revolution. The Vietnamese sort of did the same thing, except they still have a lot of, that's another story with the government corruption. But the basic problem was availability of capital, the ability of entrepreneurs to basically get themselves started and grow the economy. They kept the feudal structures in Pakistan, which basically worked against growing the economy, whereas they provided the basis of growing the economy in India, which, of course, they held back for 50 years with socialism. But, you know, they finally cut that loose 15 years ago, and the economy has been going through the roof. This has been the root problem. You go to any of these countries, and you hear the same story, or just talk to immigrants. They said, I can't get ahead in the old country. I come to America, it's a different situation. Bingo, within one generation, my kids are in college, I got my own house. What's different here? And that's it.
We just got a few minutes left.
Capital formation, but exactly what you described. You've got an economic dynamism. Economic risk is rewarded, and also protected.
We've just got a few minutes left here, but I'd like you to just kind of hit on what else you think we ought to be paying attention to here in the world in the coming week.
Oh,
everything we just said.
Iran. We talked about Iran last time, Glenn. That cannot be allowed to slip off of the political focus, off of the center of Europe's radar, political radar, the European Union, Russia, and the United States.
But there's basically nothing they can do because the Iranians, and they're open about this, they have bought the votes in the UN of Russia and China. Russia and China are then there piling up new arms and other and commercial contracts every day. Russia and China are basically bought and paid for in terms of international, diplomacy. And so the Iranians feel you can't touch us. The only help that Iran can hope for is an internal revolution because the majority of the people don't like the government that's currently in charge. But as long as that government's in charge, right now I don't see anything that can stop them from getting nukes.
Part of maintaining the focus on them is to encourage those dissidents. I mean, that's something we talked about last time. Of course, you guys know that I've been writing about and trying to encourage.
That's true. And Condoleezza Rice was just talking about the $85 million. We're going to, have more.
Drop in the bucket.
Exactly. But
drop in the bucket.
But you're right. Unless you get the people of Iran who heretofore, have voted for, reform and for a true democracy, but they're not willing to fight for it. And if they're not willing to fight for it, they're not going to get it.
Well, that's a cheerful note on which to end, but then it's kind of always like that, isn't it? If you're not willing to fight for it, you usually don't get it.
Democracy ain't free.
Thanks so much for joining us, and we look forward to having you again.
Thank you.
Glad to help.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Well, you always learn a lot listening to Austin Bay and Jim Dunnigan talk.
You sure do. These guys need their own show. Is there anybody out there who can tell us how to get these guys a show of their own?
The only bad news is, if they get a show of their own, I wonder if they'll keep coming on our show.
Who knows? Maybe they'll have us on theirs.
Now, there you go. We'll ride their fame to the apex. Anyway, we hope you enjoyed this podcast, and you can see more from them at Jim Dunnigan's site, strategypage.com, or at Austin Bay's blog, austinbay.net/blog. We'll be back again with another podcast whenever we get around to it. You can check for updates at our sites, instapundit.com or drhelen.blogspot.com, or you can subscribe via iTunes, Podcast Alley, Podcasts at Yahoo, or all kinds of other podcatching services. Take care, and we'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you next time.